Now, Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel presents The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars Pro Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's. Brought to you by Poker Stars and the Poker Players Alliance. Today, the guys are at the 2010 World Series of Poker at the Rio in Las Vegas. Another member of the Harrah's Casino family. Here are Dennis and Paul at The Final Table on 590 The Fan KFNS.
With the mountains in the background and the strip across the street, welcome to the Rio and the Dennis Phillips Suite at the 2010 World Series of Poker. I'm Paul Harrah's. Dennis and I have been here for several days now, and neither of us has won a bracelet yet.
It's amazing. You know, you have to actually play some of the events before you can win one.
That's true.
I haven't had a chance to play one yet.
And explain why you haven't been able to play in any of the tournaments and why you won't be playing for the next week or so.
Well, actually, I'm heading to Lima, Peru. I have two tournaments down there to play, playing for Poker Stars. Going down there to play the LAPT, which is a nice event down there. I think it's a $3,500 buy-in. I've got half a dozen of the pros going down there to do it. And then on June 6th and June 7th, we are having the America's Cup down there. And that is a competition that it was, again, online. You could qualify for free at PokerStars.net. If you make your way through the field, which was a massive field, I think last year was 60,000 U.S. players that were playing to narrow down to four people. This year was even bigger, so I don't know what the final figures are, but it was a lot. But those four players then get the free trip down there, spend several days at a beautiful resort, all expenses paid, and a chance to win more money.
Yeah.
Because we're going against seven other countries. We're down to eight countries left. I know that Costa Rica is involved. I know Canada's in there. The U.S. is right now in first place of the eight teams that are left. And we're going to have a sort of a round robin and go through about two different levels and see who can actually win the, quote, America's Cup.
Well, Dennis will report on that for us in a couple of weeks here on the show. And by the way, speaking of a couple of weeks from now, just one little formatic thing I got to mention. 2 weeks from today, on June 15th, our show is changing to 1 hour later. Instead of airing at 2 o'clock Tuesdays, we will be on 3 o'clock Tuesdays on 590 The Fan KFNS. And, of course, we'll be on anytime you want if you listen to the podcasts that are available on thechipleader.com. Coming up on today's show, one of the legends of poker, Barry Greenstein, who played in the 50K Poker Players Championship over the weekend. And we'll have, I'm sure, a lot of stories to tell. And we will ask him and many of the pros that we'll be talking to out here at the series about their first ever World Series of Poker experiences. Now, this is your third ever WSOP. I've been coming out here for a few years, and I actually did play in the $1,000 event this weekend. Lasted over 2 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. Right.
Well, but now then, the 1K was so interesting this time because they started out, like day one had 2,601 people in it.
Correct.
And at the end of day 1A, there was a total of 276 left.
90% of the field went out on day one of what is going to be a four-day event.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And they had over 4,000 for this first event there on it.
Yep.
They've got five more, I believe, $1,000 ones.
Now, what's interesting is last year they had their first ever stimulus special, as they called it, the 1K on that first Saturday of the series, and they had 6,021. This year they only had 4,345 combined for the 2 days.
Right.
But it's not the only 1K
exactly,
event. There were going to be six of them, as you mentioned.
Yeah, last year was the first time they reduced it down to only a $1,000 buy-in to win a bracelet, and everybody flocked into it. This year they have six of those, one on every weekend all the way through June and into July. And word of warning, folks, because I talked to one of the executives here, beware of that last one. The one that's going to go over the July 4th weekend, they are getting massive number of sign-ups on it. I think they cap it at about 7,500. This one could sell out. If you're wanting to play that 1K before the main event, you need to get online and sign up, or you need to get out here and sign up earlier.
Absolutely. So out of 4,345, 441 will be paid. Some of the people who finished day 1A of those 276, they probably thought to themselves, hey, you know what? I may have actually cashed already.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But not. They were at the end of 1A and 1B, they had something like 510 or 520 left. So people were about 75 or 80 out of the money, and they will have cashed yesterday on day two, and then day three today, and then the final table will be day four tomorrow. We won't be in any of that, but it is exciting to be here as the World Series of Poker starts up, to hear the clatter of chips in a huge room, and an even bigger room this year.
Exactly.
Because we're in the pavilion and in the Amazon room,
yep.
And the pavilion is just, it's a football field.
Yeah, no kidding. You could run wind sprints up and down that thing and tire yourselves out.
Yeah.
You know, I stand at one end of it and yell, and you hear the echoes. Unbelievable. And these tables, my gosh. This is, if you've never been to one of these World Series events, you've got to come. It's just so impressive. You walk in there in the morning when nobody else is there, and it's a massive sea of tables
yep.
across there. And then I love it when before people start sitting down, when all the dealers are there, you look and there's this one solitary dealer at every table with all the chips out. And
right.
You imagine then all of a sudden this flood of people running in there and all sitting down.
It's a beautiful sight.
It is. It's unreal.
I'll tell you what else is a beautiful sight. The cash games here. Over the last couple of years, since I haven't had a lot of tournament success at the series, and I've only played a few events here and there, I've mostly been playing cash games. And once again, my experience over this Memorial Day weekend was nothing but positive. I've been playing mostly in the 5-10 no-limit games. And it's been terrific. You actually have sat down in a couple of cash games, but mostly in some of the single-table satellites because you couldn't play in the big events.
Well, that's just it. I can't play in the big events. I've got interviews going on at different times, different things like that, but I can always free up an hour or two, and I run over there and grab one of the satellites.
Yeah.
This is great if you're not familiar with it. They have them going anywhere from $65 up to about $525. As soon as they get 10 people together, they start dealing.
Yep.
Real simple. They have them up there. You grab a card and go. 10 people sit down. Away we go. Play it down. It's just a straight sit and go. You've got to practice your game then with a full table, with a half table, and heads up. They're great, I'll tell you.
Let me just tell you about some of the guests that we've got lined up to interview here over the course of the next few weeks with our World Series 2010 coverage. Joe Seebach, Kara Scott, Vanessa Russo, Tom McAvoy, Gavin Griffin, a whole bunch of others. And Barry Greenstein is waiting in the wings, and I want to leave plenty of time for the Bear.
Oh.
So let's take an early break here. We can always tell World Series of Poker stories, but none of them will be as good as the ones I'm sure Barry has for us.
Absolutely.
So we'll get to that in just a moment. This portion of the show, our opening segment today, is brought to you by the Poker Players Alliance, the group fighting for poker players like you and me. They recently had a big protest rally in Washington State in front of that state's Supreme Court, trying to influence a decision there about playing poker in your home, in the privacy of your own home. We're pushing with the PPA for legislation in Washington. They're fighting for it in state houses around the country as well. It's a membership organization. Dennis and I have been members for a couple of years now. You should join up today. If you're listening to this podcast on your computer, take a moment to go to theppa.org and sign up for just $20. It'll be the best bet you ever made supporting poker for all of us, for freedom in the USA. A good thing to bring up after Memorial Day weekend, I think.
Very, very appropriate.
That's the Poker Players Alliance at theppa.org. This is the Final Table. Dennis Phillips, Paul Harris, and in a moment, Barry Greenstein, brought to you by Harris St. Louis on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Tuesday is Poker Day on 590 The Fan, KFNS. And this is The Final Table with Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris at the 2010 World Series of Poker. Brought to you by Harris St. Louis Casino and Hotel.
And as we continue our coverage of the 2010 World Series of Poker, our first guest today will be the first guest we ever had on this show. Back in January of 2009, he, along with Dennis, a member of Team Poker Stars Pro, one of the most respected pros in the world, Barry Greenstein is here. Barry, one of the things that we're going to ask everybody this summer out here at the World Series of Poker is memories of their first time ever coming. And, of course, for you, your first time.
Oh, I thought
of
memories of my first time somewhere else. I was trying to think of that girl. I just can't forget her name.
You know what?
Remember her name.
We'd be happy to share that story. You just may not want it on the air.
Yeah, right. People have read my book. A lot of this is in the book.
Ace on the River, a fantastic book, by the way. Not just about poker, but life.
It's not bad. No, I'm good.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Okay. But what happened is Vegas back in the 70s, you know, I went out there, you know, before I was 21 years old. I was 21 in, 75. So, you know, in the early 70s, I went out, and there was a lot of shady stuff going on. You get, like, even the card room manager bringing in a cold deck and stuff like that. And I was a professional player already, you know, from the time I was young. And I just said, I don't need this. I play in games in Illinois. I play in Houston. And when I come out to Vegas, I play. They tried to cheat me. And Yeah, I said, okay, from now on, I'm just not going to play poker in Vegas. So I come out, I might play some blackjack or something like that, go to a show, but no more poker for me in Vegas. So I didn't. I just said I just won't play there anymore. So I didn't. And then what happened is I became a no-limit hold'em player predominantly in the 80s. And I ended up pretty much running out of opposition in California at No Limit Hold'em. And some of the Vegas guys came out and played me, and they didn't fare too well. But, you know, I ended up being really strong. You know, I took on all comers. You can't do it like you do now on the Internet where you play the world, you know, like... but I played anyone who would play me and did well. And eventually... I had no choice, it seemed, but to go to the World Series. And it was actually, I was getting divorced, too, and my wife and I decided it might be a good way to separate. I'll spend a month at the World Series. We'll figure out how that's all going. I never left my kids. My kids are still, some of my kids are young. Joey, as you guys know, was a little older. Hmm. He was one of my stepkids. But my younger biological kids were a couple, few years old. But anyway, so I decided to, I'm going to go to the World Series. And just hang out there. And some of the Vegas players, like I played some with Eric Seidel, who had now started playing tournaments, and he and I were the biggest winners in the cash game that we played in at the Cameo Club, which is the predecessor to Bay 101. It was an no-limit club. And I played with guys who were, you know, very well-respected players. Bobby Hoff, Carl McKelvey were some of the guys who played back in the day. Steve Lott. These are some of the old-time Texas players. And they all knew who I was, and, you know, frankly, I was the biggest winner in the game. And but the Vegas, the regular Vegas players and the tournament players didn't know who I was. And so I didn't come out there to play tournaments. I came out there for cash games because that's how I made my living. And I remember we used to play, each year we play pot limit hold'em instead of no limit hold'em. Bobby often started the game up. And they were good games. And that's how I, you know, made my money during the World Series of Poker. I didn't care about tournaments. I didn't know they'd turn out as big as they did it. And truthfully, at that time, tournaments were for people who weren't good enough to be cash games. And so if someone was playing a tournament, it's because they just, you know, couldn't, you know, they often had someone else putting them in who was someone who was what I would call a professional player. I didn't consider the tournament players professional players. But some of them now, as we've seen, have won a lot of bracelets and built up a resume. They aren't poker players the way I think of being a poker player. Mm-hmm. But they... You know, before I started playing tournaments, I didn't start playing them until like about 2003 or 2004. Someone told me I should try to win a bracelet, so I did 1 year and I won one. It was for a TV show. Maury actually was the one who said, you know, so we can write that you've done something in tournaments. Why don't you go and try to win a bracelet at the World Series? I say, okay, I'll try to win a bracelet. You know, and I did.
I love it.
But anyway, and he said, maybe World Poker Tour events. So I played some World Poker Tour events. I won one. Okay. Uh-huh. That's how that stuff happened. Okay. Before then, I didn't play tournaments.
Wow.
Except maybe the main event and sometimes the deuce to seven and maybe one other event. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I played. But I was playing the cash games. So when it came to the main event of the World Series of Poker that year, I had a tough table, but you know, I was a no-limit hold'em player who just played no-limit hold'em all year. I still felt, frankly, I felt that was probably better than anyone in the field, and because no one had beat me back in California, and you know, I didn't, and the guys who were the most respected guys, you know, they're maybe my peers, but you know, I'd done okay against them too. Mm-hmm. And I did well, and I wasn't one of the chip leaders, but I was doing okay the whole time. And then it got to about the third day; there weren't as many days as there are now. I remember one hand. The thing about the main event, it's such an important event. And yeah. Even though it was my first one, after the first day, I was, you know, decent chips. Before I get to the hands I misplayed, because you always remember, at least I do. I probably don't remember the hands I played well. I remember the hands I misplayed, and those are that's where the lessons are. But after the first day, they used to have a betting pool, and the guy's name was Terry Rogers. I don't know if he's Scottish or whatever. And he would everyone in the field, he'd put odds out. And people would bet. And, of course, he didn't know who I was, you know, because I'd never played tournaments before. And he found me, like, right before I was about to start day two, and he said, I just want to know who you are. I said, what do you mean? He said, if you win, you're going to bust me. Or they're going to bust me. He said, all the good players bet on you to win. I didn't know who you were, and I put you at 50-1, and everybody jumped on it. And I will lose so much money if you win this thing, but I just wanted to know who the guy is who can bust me. And it was pretty funny. I didn't bust him. But I hung on for a while. I had a crucial hand I remember where I had two nines, and a guy who later became a friend of mine moved in, overshoved in, and I thought forever and folded. Or sorry, I had two queens. He raised, I re-raised, and he shoved. And I thought forever, and I folded. And I later found out he had two nines. You know, I believe him. He ended up being a good friend of mine years later, so he wouldn't have lied to me. So that was an upsetting one.
Yep.
Although I do remember I went on tilt, which I don't seem to go on tilt like that anymore, especially in tournaments. But I remember whenever I'd lose a pot in those days, I would just do everything and steal it all back. So I probably won some other pots because of it. But I also watched, and I learned a lot. He's dead now. Tom Jacobs.
Okay.
I think was at my table. And I don't think he was as good as cash game player as I was. But in the tournament, he just semi-bluffed his money all in. If he had any kind of draw, once he got some chips, he'd just ship it over and over and over. It's amazing you find out in these tournaments, a big tournament like the main event. And we've seen even guys like a Dimitri Nobles who had chips. Who's, you know, obviously, we don't think he's that good a player. We've seen a guy like Dario before. Dario's a much better player now. These are the guys who are just shipping it on people, get people to fold a lot of things where, you know, they even say, I know the guy's got a draw, but they don't want to go broke. You know, a lot of people don't want to go broke. And Tom was the first one who showed me that. And he was just coming over the top. And he was, before, you know, the internet, a guy who's also pre-flop, just three-betting relentlessly and putting the pressure on over and over and over. And even I, you know, an experienced player, had trouble with that style at that point. I eventually found out that you just four-bet him. And he can't handle it.
Yeah.
Or and if you're ever out to his left, you three-bet him. Those guys who three-bet a lot, they don't like to get three-bet. and so I did end up finding some antidotes to what he was doing. But that first year, it's like you pick up king-queen offsuit. You're raising, the guy re-raises. What do you do?
Yeah.
You know, and so it's a very tough problem, especially when he has you out-chipped. Are you going to go to war for all your chips with him? And, of course, he had 6-7, you know, whatever. So now you sometimes you say, okay, well, maybe I should call. And then you're still at his mercy. If you don't hit, and even if you hit one of them, you know, what do you do? Does he have you beat it? It's tough. When a guy puts a lot of pressure on you in that event, very tough. But I learned you know, a lot about tournament poker playing with him. He parlayed that down to second. I still remember the first year I went out 21st. And I had ace, queen of spades. And there was a guy, I think from Alaska, who had been opening. In those days, we normally open for more than three times the big blind. Now, since years gone by, people have learned that you don't, in a tournament, your short chips, you don't have to open for quite as much. Late, you can open for 2.5 times big blind. In the middle, 3 times is okay, or at the beginning. But some people open for less, play a little smaller. But in those days, people, you know, did it more based on what's in the pot and almost bet like pot limit. And so 3.5 wasn't too strange. 3.5, even 4 times the big blind wasn't a normal opening. You know, 3 maybe later stages, a little more than it is now. Well, this guy, and I can probably even still remember what the blinds must have been 15 and 3,000. He was open for like 9,500 to 10,000. And he'd opened that, and he was playing a lot of hands, and all of a sudden he opens for only 8,000, which was a smaller raise.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very upsetting to me that I had ace, queen of spades, and I had at that point only about 30,000. And again, that might sound like a lot of chips, but in those days we didn't have, you know, it was 10,000 was the buy, and I'd gotten short. So, you know, I'd probably between 30,000 and 40,000. I just said, well, the guy plays so many hands, I got to ship it. And I shipped it. And of course, he had two kings.
Yeah.
And, which is when someone shows strength or you think they're strong, you have ace, queen, you know, that hole in the middle looks like they have a king in their hand. They might have two of them.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what he represented by the under raise.
Right.
And, so this is now, that was 1991, I think. Almost 20 years later, and yeah, I haven't forgotten that. And each year, I can probably go almost year by year because I had a lot of not kind of deep runs. You know, I got in the money several. Like I made the second day of the main event like almost every year for many years in a row. And so, you know, I don't want to bring up all those bad memories. Why'd you ask me that question?
I just asked, what was your first time?
Well, that was my first time. So I went out 21st. And the other funny thing about it, and again, it's in my book. Is in those days, 21st paid 8,100 or something like that.
Oh,
it didn't
gosh.
Pay the 10,000 back.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And you might say, well, you were in the last place. They paid 36 places. I didn't even come in the last bracket. Someone else got less than I did. Probably got 7,000. They paid 36 places out of about 300, I would guess it was around 300 entries.
Yeah.
And so I lost. You know, 1,900 on the deal. And at that time, I only had 10,000 was a reasonable amount of money for me back then. You know, for the games I was playing, I didn't play in the big games with Doyle and those guys. You know, maybe I had, you know, and I had a family, so I'm shipping money back. You know, I probably only had like a few thousand more with me besides my buy-in when I played the main event, and then I got that 8,100. And I was really upset because I was also, as you can see, I'm still upset the way I played the hand. I mean, I don't know what you're supposed to do with ace, queen of spades against a guy like that, but I guess I don't know if I should have folded pre-flop. It was a difficult hand, but whatever. So anyway, I was very upset when I went out because, you know, I actually felt, yeah, I was very confident about my Nolan holding those games in those days, and I felt I was the best player in the field, and I felt I had a shot to win it my first time out, and I felt when I looked around at my tables, I always felt like I was the strongest players. And remember, tournament players, now we have a lot of good players who play tournaments. You have guys, you know, just to name names, whether it's Amit Makiya, Vivek Rajkumar, Isaac Barron, Sorel Mizzi, good players, right? In those days, if someone was a good player, they weren't playing tournaments. They were playing cash games. But now we have some of the good players do play in tournaments because there's extra stuff you can get out of tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
So a tournament field was, to me, just a bunch of donkeys. And so I'm supposed to win this tournament. If I was playing a cash game, I think everyone's money's mine. And it was that same mentality. I'm going to get all the chips.
I love it.
And so it didn't work out that way. I was very frustrated. I walked over to the Golden Nugget, and I blew that money at blackjack in 15 minutes.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
And I went home broke, and I played at the Cameo Club. You know, Marco Trapani, who's the CEO at the Bay 101, you know, he's a good friend of mine, ran the Cameo Club. And I went to the Cameo Club the next day, and there's a banner up on the wall, "Congratulations, Barry," because there I didn't even think about it. From your hometown, the World Series is still pretty big back then, and if you got that deep now, it'd be the same thing. I'm sure it was for you when you had your run.
Absolutely.
Everyone had been, there wasn't an internet in those days, but they were somehow getting the reports, calling Binion. The way you used to do it back then is you'd actually call the desk at Binion's and you'd say, give me the top 10 shift counts, and they would read them off. That's how they used to do it.
Yeah.
So people are just calling in the switchboard over and over and over and tracking me, and they were all following me, and I went out 21st, and I really felt, I said, Marco, not only did I lose money on that, I didn't even get back my buy-in. I went broke 15 minutes after I got knocked out. I kind of embarrassed that you guys are congratulating me. They said, yeah, but we all, for 3 days, you know, we're all following you. It was great for us. Everyone was excited.
Yeah, they live vicariously through your experience.
Absolutely. Right. Well, fortunately, they didn't get to live vicariously through the aftermath of that event.
So what's your schedule for the World Series this year? You played in the 50K. You're going to be in the main event. What are you doing in between?
Well, I'll be playing every day. And for tournaments, it's good for me if the cash games are worse. That means, what I used to do when I was younger, like 50 years old, was I would play the tournaments all day once I started playing tournaments. And then when I was done at 2 in the morning, I'd go to the Bellagio and play that till like about 7 in the morning if there was a cash game going on. And, I was caught sleeping at the tables many times, you know, actually taking cat naps and stuff like that because I played the World Series 40 days, I'd hear these young kids saying, oh, that tournament schedule is really grueling. You play almost every day. And I'm thinking, every day? I'm playing every waking hour and some of the sleeping hours. You know, I mean, what a bunch of wimps. To just play tournaments is, even at my age, it's just a joke. If I just played tournaments, no, that's not grueling. I've been playing poker my whole life. That's nothing.
Please stop saying my age.
Yeah.
You know, Dennis is only a couple years younger than you, and I'm only a couple years younger than him.
So.
We're three middle-aged guys here.
Actually, my age isn't the problem anymore, but from sitting in front of a computer, whether I was programming or playing poker and sitting at a poker table, the last few years I've gotten out of the habit of getting enough exercise. I used to play a lot of sports when I was young, and I was always in good shape. And so all you poker players who think you're invincible and you're in your 20s, you know, get good habits, not bad habits. And the good habits are doing, whether you exercise and go to the gym or just play some sports, you'll make that something you do outside of poker. You know, there are too many kids who get single-minded and are just eating and playing poker. That's not probably a good way to run your life.
But all that good casino food.
Yeah, right. There you
go. Well, no, this isn't casino food. This is like pizza ordered out while they're sitting at their computer at home.
Right.
Barry Greenstein is our guest here at the final table. This segment is brought to you by PokerStars.net. Go there. I'm telling you guys, it's amazing what you've got there. We've got everything now. New promotions coming up. There's an NHL charity shootout where you can sit down with some of the stars, some of the best players in hockey. Places going on right now, the big game, qualifying for that, and going on TV and playing against the pros, against somebody like Barry or myself.
In fact, in a moment, when we come back from a commercial break here, we're going to talk to Barry about the big game because he recorded one of those first episodes.
I'm interested to see what goes there.
I think it starts airing just 2 weeks from now.
About June 14th, time on that.
So we'll get into that in just a moment.
Absolutely. You've got the NAPT events that are coming up. They haven't been announced yet, but I know there's going to be several more at the end of, before the end of the year. You've got chances to go to Australia for free. You've got chances to go to Latin America for free. It's amazing the things you can get. Go to PokerStars.net, and for free, you can travel the world and play poker. Nothing better than that I can think of.
Yep. Find the poker star in you at PokerStars.net. And find the final table when we return from this quick break. Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris, brought to you by Harris St. Louis. Every week here on 590 The Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcasts on TheChipLeader.com.
From the Rio in Las Vegas, this is The Final Table with the St. Louis poker pro who beat over 13,000 other players in the past 2 years at the World Series of Poker main event. That's Dennis Phillips and his co-host Paul Harris, brought to you by Harris St. Louis Casino and Hotel on 590 The Fan KFNS.
All of our guests here at the World Series of Poker are getting some of our Final Table gear. We've got hats, we've got shirts, we've got sweatshirts. You can get yours by going to the website, thechipleader.com. Click on the shop button and then get your Final Table merchandise, just like all the poker stars who are coming up here and talking with us are wearing when they walk out of here and then down into the Amazon room and the pavilion room of the 2010 World Series of Poker. And one of those stars is Barry Greenstein, who's sitting here with us right now.
Barry, I guess you were in the inaugural shooting of the big game, the new game that's coming out from Poker Stars. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How did it go?
Well, you know, we need to stand on the shoulders of giants, as Newton once said. And high-stakes poker, most people felt, was the best show on television.
Yep.
Maury Eskandani, Eric Drake, Henry Ornstein, all friends of mine, did a great job. Mm-hmm. But Poker Stars, they have a way of taking something that's good and making it better, whether it's the poker tours or whatever. You know, they see what the needs are. And the reason they're able to do that is because they have a nice side business.
So this is true.
So all these different things that we see, whether it's the tournament in the Bahamas or, you know, the EPT, all these things, those are branding, you know, efforts for Poker Stars. You can call them loss leaders if you look at the other things. You know, they're not out there to make money. They have a way to make money. But they end up putting out what I would call really good poker products.
Yes.
And so it's hard for other people to compete right now with Poker Stars being the biggest poker website, that they can just do things in a grander fashion than anyone else can. So that's what happened here is the top brass at Poker Stars just said, what would make that better? You know, what could we do? And and usually the guys they talked to are me and Daniel on the poker side. So it's nice because we're poker players, and so we get to usually do things that are good for the poker players. And then on the marketing side, they asked, I remember in the conversation, what's the best channel to have it on? No one else can ask that. Everyone else is on some, small cable channel or something like that. Obviously even the World Series it's on ESPN, but that's a cable channel.
Mm-hmm.
No, Poker Stars thinks big. It's like, what's the best channel? NBC, CBS, Fox, what are we putting on? And so, we said for poker, ESPN is still a good channel. Mm-hmm. So they put the NAPT on that. Fox, not Fox Sports, which is a totally different thing. That they'll do poker with us. They got a big viewership. We'll do it there. Mm-hmm. So it just ends up being leaps and bounds above. And one of the problems that we had, and Maury's a good friend of mine, I talk to him all the time, we always have this thing where these businessmen, which will kind of help generate action, will get the players wanting to play. You still want to try to make money. We have these businessmen who say, yeah, I'll put up 500,000 or a million, I'll play with these guys. And then they get cold feet at the end because they don't want to look stupid on television. Or, sometimes it may even be just for their own business reasons. There have been times, you take an example, a guy like Andy Beal, mm-hmm. who is actually a much better player than people recognize, playing the best players in the world at Heads Up Limit Hold'em. But the pressure of, people saying he wasn't good, because he ended up losing, which anyone probably would have under those circumstances, having to play a barrage of players. Now he's a billionaire businessman. He ends up having to defend himself I mean, the truth is, anyone who played him lost it sometime. Okay, you know, he actually really did a great job. But someone's going to win and someone's going to lose. And so a businessman like him, eventually, he's doing it really for the challenge. Does he need the headaches? Does he need people, like, making fun of him, ridiculing him? And so we have that same phenomenon on this show, where who wants to... I mean, obviously, they're not professional players. Andy actually was closer to them because he really studied hard. But I'm saying the normal guy is going to be more of a recreational player. He doesn't want to end up looking bad. Now, so PokerStars comes up and says, how about we give the guy money? We have some people qualify.
Yeah.
We'll give him money. They can't feel embarrassed. It's a free roll for them. And now the other people in the game are going to you know, be incentivized to play because, you know, it looks like a better shot to make money. And one of the two sessions I played in had a businessman also besides the loose cannon. Ours was a tight cannon relative, although he did bluff me out. He made a good play against me, or I made a bad play against him. We had a guy, and I can't remember his name now, was a real fun player. Got stuck almost $200,000. Actually, I can't even say. But it was an interesting show. It was really fun for the players, and real, what we're hoping is it's going to be fun for the viewers. You know, I was involved, and so were some of the other people, in what statistics we're going to show, and we tried to bring that to another level, too. We're going to show different graphics, you know, some of the normal online statistics like the VPIP, you know, voluntarily money put in the pot, you know, in other words, how many hands you play, and also, you know, maybe your pre-flop raising percentages and stuff like that, and a couple other things. So we think it, I mean, you know, we're all like, anyone who's been involved in the show, June 14th, I think, is the air date, is saying, you know, we really want to hear what the feedback's going to be. The only problem that we all have is the feedback usually comes from the forum committee or the forum community, and the forum community is the vocal 1% of poker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that is so true.
And so the problem is we don't get to hear from that other 99%, which is critical to get advertising money. And so, you know, at some point we need to do a better job of finding out what the rest of the world wants, because mm-hmm. they're actually mm-hmm. more important than the you know, than the ones we hear from.
And the ones on those forums, they hate everything.
Yeah, I mean, well, in this particular show, I'll see. I think most are going to be saying, why aren't I the guy? I mean, all these guys are wanting, everyone who's not a player who has the money to put on the yeah. 100,000 will want to be the loose cannon. And I'm sure they'll all be saying, I could have won money and I would have played better than him. Actually, it seemed for the most part we had really good loose cannons. You know, they screened them for television savviness or whatever you want to call it. They want to make sure that they're gregarious and you know, that they think they have a good story, stuff like that. And so, you know, that's the first component. But they also, for the most part, seem like decent players. They seem like they all had a shot to make money, which I guess, although $100,000 might be a lot of money to me and you, but to PokerStars it's not quite so much. So, mm-hmm. But maybe they were trying to protect their investment a little bit.
So is it you and three or four other PokerStars pros plus the loose cannon and maybe a business person? Is that what the show is going to be?
Yeah, well, the way it is, it was normally going to be the loose cannon, and it's not all PokerStars pros. Everyone was invited, and you know, that includes Full Tilt pros.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always this thing, our Full Tilt pros, because there's kind of like a little, I can't say the bad word for it, but let's say
it's rivalry.
Yeah, the rivalry with poker. You know, they're doing stuff, which I think is a mistake. You know, I never, you know, those are my friends at Full Tilt or at Doyle's Room or wherever they are. I always want what's best for poker players.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
and a way for them to make the most money. So you'll never hear me saying something that's like competitive, like, oh, no, don't let those guys play or this or that against another player.
Right.
So there, you know, everyone from all the sites or non-sites are welcome on the show. But to be able to put up $100,000 and compete, that's still in this economy a lot of money. So you're going to normally get good players. We had, for the most part, so they weren't PokerStars players. You know, I noticed they have a commercial. The main PokerStars players they were showing were me, Daniel, Jason Mercier, and
Vanessa.
And Vanessa.
Yeah.
And so they kind of assumed we were going to play, or they got the word that we were going to play. And then, you know, they had a couple others.
Mm-hmm.
But at my table, Jason was at my table at one point, but I can't remember if there were other PokerStars pros. There was probably just other good players. I remember Danny Ali was at my table.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, Isaac Haxton was there. You know, so these aren't These are some tough players who, you know, feel it's a good spot for them.
Yeah. Since we're talking about TV cash games, and you mentioned high-stakes poker, you've done that show. Were you on it every season so far?
Yeah.
Do you think that the show has changed to a point where it's not profitable for you to go on that show anymore?
No, I've made money. I only go there for the money, and I always have from the beginning. And, yeah, I've made money every year, but I've won small loss. And if I thought it wasn't profitable, I don't need, you know, some people, even Dennis at this stage in his career, is going partly for to get his name. He knows it's a big show. It's good for marketing reasons for him, especially representing PokerStars. That's what many of the people are thinking. I want to be on that show because people talk about that show. I'm past that point in my career. People know who I am. If it got to where I thought I rated to lose on the show, it might even be bad for me. You know, I got bluffed out of one hand by Durr, and then I already heard I was over the hill.
Yet,
you know, so I don't need that. You know, if I go there and play that game because I think I'm ready to make money, and I'm always, they know that I'll play in whatever the lineup is, and I still think I'm a favorite. So I always end up with, if Ivy's there and if Patrick's there and if Durr's there, I'm going to be at their table. You know, people think obviously, they're pretty tough players. I don't, those are guys I don't want to play head up, but eight-handed. My problem isn't, you know, obviously they're good players, but if it's those three and some other players, I think I'm going to be a favorite. My biggest problem is me, because in this way, I don't play that much no limit hold 'em anymore. I'm more mixed game player. I used to play it years back. So I'm rusty and those guys are in stroke. That puts me at one disadvantage. And I'm older and past my prime at this point, and they're in their prime, a lot of them. Well, Tom's before his prime, but Phil and Patrick are close to their prime.
Yeah.
So I'm fading that, and that's the tough thing. You know, if I was doing it right, I probably should, play a week or so of cash, no limit hold 'em before I sit down in that game. One of the reasons that I'm not able to a lot of times is a lot of the no-limit games don't have antes, and tournaments are different than that also, although the tournaments do have antes. It's hard to prepare exactly right for that game, to find the right side game to simulate it. So it's easier said than done to prepare for it.
Interesting. And you say that Tom Dwan is before his prime and you're after your prime? You know, there are a lot of people who would not agree with your assessment there, Barry.
No, I mean, Tom is obviously, you know, as I said to him, he made me lay him odds like on this eight game. We cross-booked it, and I kept saying, hey, come on, I'm 50 years old. I keep getting worse every year. And I said, you keep getting better each year by the amount I keep getting worse. Obviously, if that's true, we got to cross paths at this point. But he made me lay him odds anyway. But and he was out the first day, so I didn't feel so bad about it. But it looks like I'm going to be out here in the third day. I'm real short.
Oh, you're not out yet, though. You still got chips. What is it, 15?
What, you think Tom Dwan is past his prime, or did you understand?
No. I think you're both in your prime.
Oh, you think I'm in my prime at 55 years old? No. I make so many – I'm still upset yesterday. I make so many mistakes that I'm always having trouble figuring out. Are they from rustiness, like in a no-limit hold'em situation? This was a no-limit hold'em hand that I'm upset about, or are they from age? And it's probably a combination of both. You know, I see things that I do. As a matter of fact, you know, I'm sure you know Phil Ivey's a good friend of mine, and you know, we even at times, you know, sat next to each other and played like online stuff like that. And I notice, you know, I still, although it bothers him, think I know more about poker than Phil. But and you know, I helped him some when he was coming up. But the one thing I see that he does better than I do, which is so critical, is he does what he wants to do at the time. And I remember when I was young, I would hear people like saying things like, I know I should raise, or I know I should call you here, and then they wouldn't do it. Like people would say they think they know what the right play is, but they do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I always used to think, what morons, you know, yeah. If I think something's the right play, if I think I should, you know, bluff all in or whatever, I'm going to make that play. I always made the play that I thought was the right play, almost like as an academic exercise. But now, I mean, I still try to make the right play, but what happens to me since I've gotten older is I make a play, whether it's a raise, fold, or call, or whatever it is, and then maybe 5-10 seconds later, I will say, no, I shouldn't have done that. I should have raised that. Like I'll fold, I say, no, now I see that, you know, I probably could have taken him off his hand. I do certain things where I don't process the information as quickly as I did when I was younger. And so one of the things that some of the younger players who, you know, there are a lot of young players, especially now that we have these mixed games going on, you know, come to me for advice. And, you know, we might get to talking about this stuff. And they'll say, well, why don't you take more time? You seem to always know in the analysis, you know, you have a good idea of what the right line is, what the right thing to do is. But I've been playing for 40 years. My tempo is a very quick tempo. It's just, it's like saying change your golf swing now all of a sudden, you know, slow it down or speed. It's hard for me to do because I've played with that tempo because I don't want to give away anything. And maybe online that's good advice because you can take time online where people don't know if you're doing something else, playing, you know. But live, you know, you try to, you know, do one beat, two beats or whatever. I don't count it out. But yeah, kind of the same tempo where you do it with a strong hand, a weak hand, a drawn hand, or a made hand, whatever.
Absolutely.
And so it's, you know, it can give away information, and it's just not my nature to do it. It's I should be more deliberate, and I'm trying to, but, you know, I'm still screwing up, and I'm still I played a hand yesterday. It cost me $50,000 that I was complaining about, and then someone said, well, tell me it. And I said, no, it's too embarrassing. You know, I mean, it's getting to the point where some of the hands I can't even talk about, they're getting so bad.
Wow. You realize, I don't know if you realize this, but for our listeners, yeah, particularly people who are 1-3 players or 2-5 yeah, players, or yeah, they've worked their way up to 5-10, mm-hmm, or they're playing tournaments that they're buying into for $40 or $100, what you just said is so reassuring to them, Barry, that here's a world-famous poker player who says to himself the same thing that we all say to ourselves, which is, oh, my God, I was an idiot. Why didn't I just take 3 more seconds and think about it? I would have known the right thing to do there.
Well, anyone who isn't saying that is not getting better and is fooling themselves. And any time you hear someone saying, oh, no, I just made all the right decisions, I played a perfect yeah, session, that's either because they're not very bright or because their game doesn't have, you know, it's not that full. If they're never taking people off when they have the worst hand, I guess if they're only playing the nuts or only playing their really, really good hands, that's one way to play poker, but it's not the best way to play poker.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a simplified strategy if they think they're always making the right play. You know, I have a strategy that with any two cards may try to raise someone out of a pot if I think that I can get them off their hand. And I've got to see what the signs are that they're either A, weak, or B, even they're strong, I can still take them off. You know, this 8 game has an interesting dynamic where people are going to lay, people who are good at the limit games are going to try to not go off in the big bet games. And so even if they're decent players, you know, for instance, even for myself, I know that I can, you know, I'm better than, you know, most of the field at the limit games.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll, you know, I'm just thinking to myself, as long as I don't go broke in some cooler and no limit holder or pot limit Omaha, or I don't, like, you know, or I don't make a play that doesn't work, they're in trouble against me in the other game. So I don't want to take a risk in some case. Well, you can use that, and you got to know who wants to play the big bet games and who wants to play the limit games. And so that dynamic, you know, factors into what you should be doing and what you should think they're doing.
That's so astute. That's absolutely right. I'm telling you, if I'm weak on a limit and I want to push mine in on the no limits, I'm just going to try and stay even on the limits the whole time, not lose a big pot, keep my chips so I can put them in on the games I'm more comfortable with. Very astute.
Right. Well, anyway, so yeah, and it means you have to know your players. And
absolutely.
So, you know, I had an interesting hand that I misplayed, not as badly as the one I can't talk about. But it was against Joe Cassidy. It was the very last hand of the night, the first night. I had good chips. I had almost 260,000. I had ace-six of hearts, and I was in the big blind. He raised one to the right of the button. And the antes are heavy in this event because we only have 2 big bet games out of the 8 games, so they make it so at least there's something in there in the no-limit hold'em. Joe raised a little less than 3 times the big blind, and I called. And, again, my table was weak enough. I had a good first-day table that I almost would have said just fold out anything but near the nuts and PLO and no limit hold'em because they really couldn't play with me in the limit games. This was the last hand of the night. I wouldn't have folded it anyway because I had more chips than anyone else at the table, which is another important reason to play some of the big bet games. If you have people out chipped, you can put pressure on them in a tournament. And so it was more reason for me to start running over people at the big bet games at that point. But, you know, Joe Cassidy's obviously a good player, and he raised in, and I called in the big blind, and the flop came, looked like kind of like gin, ace-king-deuce with the king-deuce of hearts.
Mm.
Wow. I had $260,000 starting the hand. He only had $120,000. So even if I end up going all in and losing the $120,000, I'd be back to my starting stack, and it wouldn't be tragic.
Mm-hmm.
And I like in a no-limit tournament to play these hands really fast. Nut flush draws by themselves, let alone top pair nut flush draws. You know, I play them fast. Even if I'm wrong and the guy has ace-queen and decides to go with it, which I may end up even on the fourth bet getting him to lay it down, frankly, where he'll think I have aces up. If I'm wrong, I still have my outs, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I may have my six is an out in addition to the flush cards. The only problem with it being ace-king-deuce instead of, let's say, ace-jack-deuce is that he pretty much knows I don't have ace-king, so he can take me off that, which makes it easier for him to play an ace-queen through, and it also means that he, as the leader coming in the pot, could be the one with the ace-king,
yeah,
which is dangerous. So he bet a normal continuation bet. He had brought it in for brought it in for $2,500 actually, which is a little low because with the antes and everything, most people would have brought it in for at least $3,000. But anyway, we brought it in for $25, and on the flop, he bet. And Joe does raise in for less than most people, a little bit of a small ball guy. He bet $3,500 on the flop. And the question is what to do. And, I'll put it to you, Dennis. What do you think?
I'd probably re-raise him right there.
Yeah, well, that's what I did. And for me, for you, it might be the right play. For me, it was the wrong play. And exactly because of what I was saying. It's wrong for me to create too big a pot in these big bet games when I have such an edge in the limit games.
Mm.
And so in a no-limit tournament, I probably would have raised and wouldn't have minded. You know, if it's a big pot, it's a big pot.
Sure.
Well, you win some of those. But with me having an edge on the field in the limit games, I probably should have kept this small.
I understand.
And I probably just should have called and let him fire again and call and maybe on the river decide to call the third barrel if he's going to try to blow me off. And I think it's that. Or he may give up. Or I may end up making a hand, aces up, or a flush or something like that. But what happened is I raised. And remember, I'm out of position. I'm in the big blind. I raised to 10,000.
Okay.
And I would have been satisfied to take it there. And I raised, of course. One of the reasons you raise, you don't want to give the guy a free card.
Sure.
You don't want to let... by calling, you may end up, Joe's capable of three barreling and making me fold down the river, too. You know, there are reasons like that. I certainly would be sick if he had two eights and the wrong eight comes off. But, of course, it could be the eight of hearts if he didn't have that in his hand. So there are good scenarios there, too. But I raised, and so now what do I do? He called. And he called like he felt he had the best hand at that point. You know, that was my time. In fact, I don't know what happens to other players, but for me, very often, the internet guys always talk about what's the guy's range. As a live player, because you get a little more, usually like a hand will pop into my mind. In any game I'm playing, I'll say, this is the hand I think he's most likely, or feels like he has. And I often get it down to one or two hands, and when I was younger more than I was older, I was right an astounding amount of the time. Not as accurate. Part of the reason I'm not as accurate as I used to be also, not only age, is limit poker took away a lot of my feel, because in limit poker you play fast. You got to call the guy down so many times it's not worth wasting your energy on what exactly hand
right.
he had. And no limit, that's more relevant. But the hand that scared me and popped in my head actually was three kings, because he called like there was no doubt he had to call, but the tempo like... not like he was on a drawer was questionable either. Like, there wasn't any question he had to call, okay?
Okay.
So that was actually the hand that popped in my head. And then the four clubs comes on the turn, and now what do? I think I'm beat. I don't think I can make him fold. And he only bet. I end up checking.
Okay.
Because I just felt, in a no-limit tournament, I might fire again. Because I figure if I check, he's going to bet anyway, and so maybe I should fire. Sometimes he'll fold with a king-queen or something like that, right? I didn't think he had the king queen type hand, and I decided to check. And now he bet 18,000. And I looked in the pot, and at first it seemed like a reasonable call because I have a lot of chips.
Right.
And even sometimes, if I think I can get the guy off his hand, if I think he's got ace queen or ace jack, I'm just going to move in at this point and let him worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I had aces and fours. Maybe I had aces and deuces. Maybe I had three deuces. Let him. And for his tournament life, he probably will fold ace queen or ace jack. But I didn't feel like he had ace-queen or ace-jack. I thought he might even bet more than that with ace-queen or ace-jack, to put the pressure on me and make me fold instead of, leaving me in. This is come on, I'll play with you. 18,000 isn't too much.
Yep.
When I just raised to 10,000, the pot's, before the flop, we put in 5,000. After the flop, we put in 20,000. $25,000. So it was 25 plus, you know, some handies and stuff like that. A little less than 30,000, I guess, in the pot. You know, 18,000, close to two-thirds of the pot. You know, what odds am I getting if I call and I make my flush and I don't get paid off? Well, you know, I'd like to get, you know, 3 or 4 to 1 at least, because I'm out of position. I'm not going to get much in implied odds. A heart comes and I bet out. If a heart comes, can I check and expect him to bet? I don't think so.
No.
Can I bet out and expect to get called? The hands, most of the time, not. You know, if he has three kings, obviously he's going to call me.
Right.
But some hands he won't. And what if, you know, there's also that four of hearts now that the four of clubs came in the board. What if that card comes? Now what do I do if I'm wrong? So, you know, I was thinking about all these things, and I just felt that, again, you know, the last thought was, well, you know, on the limit hands, I've still got a good enough edge. Why throw away another 18,000, no limit? You know, I decided it was wrong to call. Most people would have called there, I think.
Yeah, I think they...
And what I decided was I just, you know, misplayed the hand. I should have called the 3,500 and called his... And Joe bets small, and, you know, I think he underbets a lot of times. I think he would have bet 6 or 7,000 on the turn, call that. Maybe he'll give up on the river when I have the best hand, or mm-hmm. maybe I'll draw out one when he has the best hand. So that left a bad taste in my mouth the last hand of the night, but I still had good chips, so it wasn't so bad. And I talked to Joe the next day. We're pretty good friends. And I told him, you know, I told him my hand and how I was upset the way I played it. And he told me he had ace king.
Okay.
We don't know what the river was.
Right.
Rabbit
right.
Yeah.
So.
Were you thinking at any point that not only did you have the hearts, but the six as a live card?
Well, of course I did.
Yeah. So when he tells you ace king, you can go, okay. Whew.
Yeah, at least I didn't have the six. It was just all hearts.
Right.
Interesting. And I see your reason for doing it. Yeah, I probably would have played it different. I probably would have stronger in the no limit.
That's so. Right. So for you, playing exactly. a big pot and trying to win in the no limit is a reasonable strategy. For
right.
me, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, it makes sense.
Barry, thanks so much for joining us here at the Final Table. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Okay. I'm glad to be on with you guys.
Right.
And I hope if I do something big, I'll come back. How's that? So if you don't hear from me again, I guess it's my fault.
Well, I know. I'm not worried about that. I just hope you're really good luck, except if you're at my table.
Okay.
In any of these.
Okay. Well, I'll have good luck against some of the other players. How's that?
There you go.
First of all, I don't ever remember taking any of your chips, so you're safe.
Yeah. Barry Greenstein joining us here at the Final Table on thechipleader.com and on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.